Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Quantum Enigma, set in the Human Chronicles universe, by T.R. Harris, narrated by Perry Daniels. Chapter 1. Adam Kane sat in the passenger seat of the armored personnel carrier, as welcoming heat blasted from vents in the dashboard. The terrain outside looked like the worst version of hell, a frozen wasteland of mushy tundra and bitter, windswept cold on a planet already classified as a dead world. Adam was often amazed at what some people fought and died over. Granted, the rest of the planet wasn't as bad as this. Not much. However, Koresh Nor would never be confused for paradise. But for some, it was home. For others, their last stop. And that was the reason for the one-sided battle taking place in the valley below. Fortunately for Adam, the APC was buttoned up, toasty and warm, segregated from the reality of the carnage taking place a few miles away. The vehicle was painted in the bright blue of the Enforcer Corps, with a stylized logo emblazoned on the roof. Adam and his organization had yet to pick sides in the conflict, so for now his two-vehicle convoy was a neutral third party, only observers, with no dog in the race. He lifted the binoculars again and scanned the battlefield. It wasn't going well for the natives. It wasn't a large unit, only about 30 or so, escorting cargo of some kind in a six-truck caravan. The mercenaries caught them by surprise in the lowland, coming in from the south with troops and half a dozen hovercraft gunships. The force sent against the natives was overwhelming, the battle a foregone conclusion. The reality of the situation made him feel guilty, sitting here while not lifting a hand to help the overmatched natives. But he was here to observe, not to take part in the fighting. But considering the level of brutality he saw being committed by the former MK employees, Adam thought it was about time for a change to his neutrality position. But that wasn't the only reason Adam was on the planet. He was also here for his mental health. Through the haze of explosions and the steady beat of faraway bolt launchers, even the proximity of action beat shuffling reports across his desk on Navaris, which was what Adam did most of the time these days. For a person such as him, that was a fate worse than death. And although he was far from the shit down range, the atmosphere of battle was better than nothing at all. The pressure of his job as the top cop in the dead zone, and now the head of the default paramilitary force across 100 worlds, was more than he'd bargained for. He wasn't built for management. He was a soldier at heart, a fighter rather than a strategist or politician. Besides that, he was having withdrawals. 2 years had passed since Adam last killed an alien. In fact, the last person he killed wasn't even an alien. It was another human. Wolfgang Stemmel, the former regional director for the gigantic Maris Kliss organization. Adam smiled. He'd never seen a person consumed by a miniature black hole before. It was impressive, both in its effect and its finality. There was no coming back from that. And what made it even more satisfying was the fact that Stemmel suffered his fate because he'd stolen Adam's hybrid artificial telepathy device, his ATD, and installed it into his body. The Formilians built the device not only to interact with Adam's brainwaves, but also to absorb a limited number of energy bolts, venting the power through a microscopic black hole deep within its circuits. Stemmel didn't know the absorption rate was limited, thinking he was immune to flash weapons. He found out the hard way that that wasn't the case.
Better him than me, Adam thought.
And now another 2 years had gone by since that fateful day at the ancient Eris base. And what a 2 years it had been. First of all, politics in the dead zone had shifted dramatically. After Stemmel's death, the true extent of his plans for galactic domination using the stolen dark matter collectors came to light, causing the huge MK conglomerate to distance itself even farther from both the director and the zone. Although Stemmel's two DMCs hadn't been found yet, his organization was no longer considered a threat. That left the 26 worlds he quasi-owned in the zone without status, stranding the 3 million employees and 900,000 mercenaries on these planets without his protection. The workers and security troops had spent the prior 3 years striving to bring the infrastructure on the worlds up to code, and now their efforts were in vain. The situation grew worse for the former MK employees when officials in the zone passed a decree giving legal ownership of the dead worlds back to the natives. The order applied to Stemmel's planets as well. But in a strange twist of fate, the powers that be allowed the MK personnel to remain, giving them the status of provisional citizens, or PCs. That didn't make the situation better, only worse. When the millions of refugees flowed back to their home worlds, Stemmel's worlds were already occupied by a determined and highly skilled population, who felt entitled to their piece of the pie. And rather than join together for the common good, natives and PCs immediately faced off for domination of the planets. The PCs felt they had too much time and labor invested in the rebuilding of the worlds to let the returning natives push them aside. They also had a highly trained security force for protection, which also had a vested interest in keeping what they now considered to be theirs. The refugees, on the other hand, were far less skilled and with fewer resources. After Kratian's pass through the region over 10 years before, most of the wealthy, privileged, and skilled took what they could and disappeared into the vastness of the expansion, and to a lesser degree, the Orion Cygnus Union. And although these natives now had official ownership of their home worlds, few were willing to give up their comfortable lives of wealth and privilege on the more sophisticated worlds in the galaxy to return to the barely habitable planets of their birth. The dead worlds were still decades away from returning to any semblance of normalcy. Although the air was clear of radiation, the land was still recovering, as were the oceans and waterways. Entire ecosystems had to be rebuilt, including insects for pollination and bacteria for nutrient recovery, along with all the other varieties of life that depended on one another for food. Besides, most anything of value in the major cities had already been stripped away by salvagers, leaving critical infrastructure beyond repair and requiring a complete overhaul. Entire industries had to be rebuilt or reintroduced, which required money and skill that the returning refugees lacked. That was what the PCs had been working on for the past 3 years. The natives, on the other hand, had been the common laborers, the stewards, the minor merchants, and ship's crews, who were off-planet at the time of Kratian's attack. Their hearts were in the right place, but not the means to revive their ravaged worlds. Yet still they came, simply because they had nowhere else to go. The situation was bad enough on the majority of worlds that hadn't been under Stemmel's control. There wasn't a resident population that had to be either accommodated or evicted. It was infinitely worse on the former MK worlds. Although the returning refugees had the law on their side, and they outnumbered the MK personnel 10-1, they were no match for the expertise of the MK technicians or the power of the mercenaries. The PCs were well entrenched, and having been abandoned by MK and their supporters, these castoffs had nowhere else to go, and they weren't about to leave without a fight. And that's where Adam Kane came in. He sighed deeply as the thoughts passed through his mind. His life had changed considerably in the past 2 years, and none of it to his liking. After the Stemmel debacle, both the Union and the expansion backed off from attempting overt control of the dead zone. Instead, they proposed that Adam's Enforcer Corps become the new military in the region. For his part, Adam had very little say in the decision-making. With both empires unified in this cause, there was nothing he could do to stop it. and with new wars starting almost monthly, something had to be done. The enforcers took over Camp Forrester, south of Balamar, and expanded it tenfold. Then, with military recruiters and trainers from across the galaxy, thousands of personnel flooded onto Navaris to become part of the new paramilitary force. Soon, Adam's small, mostly planetary police force numbered 60,000, and to support such a population, both the expansion and Union donated the equipment and material required to operate such a large organization. The enforcers wanted for nothing. Everything was provided. The logic was simple. The empires would let the enforcers do the fighting until the zone was pacified, and then the chits would be called in. Adam remained at the top of the enforcer hierarchy, but instead of referring to him as Marshal Kane, his human buddies began facetiously calling him Field Marshal Kane. He didn't think it was funny, and if it weren't for the fact that the governments were throwing so much money at him to remain the head of the enforcers, he would have quit long ago. The mission of his enforcers was also convoluted. They were tasked with maintaining peace in the dead zone, but what exactly did that mean? At present, major wars were taking place on 19 worlds, with another 32 enmeshed in deadly terrorist conflicts and mass murder on a horrendous scale. And never was there a clear enemy. Adam couldn't very well send his troops to smash one side of the conflict when both sides had standing. His enforcers ended up being more referee than a participant in the wars. That did neither party any good, resulting in wholesale slaughter and tens of thousands of deaths, and the dead worlds didn't have the population to spare. Each person who died in a battle was an essential cog in the wheel, vital to the eventual recovery of the planets. That didn't matter. No one was thinking rationally nor compassionately. A particularly powerful rocket landed a mile or so from the APC, shaking Adam from his reverie. The valley below was shrouded in a thick blanket of black smoke, held down by the cold, dense air of the frozen wasteland. "Is this place really worth dying for?" Adam thought for the 100th time. None of the dead worlds had populations larger than 2 million, including natives and PCs. That meant that each person could, for all practical purposes, claim a city, town, or hamlet for their own, with plenty left over. There was no need to fight over what other people had. But that wasn't the case. Everyone seemed to gravitate to the 5 or 6 major cities on each of the planets, the ones that MK and Stemmel had made the most progress in reclaiming. It made sense. Adam snorted. But by the time the battles were over, most of the cherished communities would be nothing but burned-out wastelands, worse than any of the thousands of surrounding communities. It didn't make sense that the warring parties would waste so many lives fighting over a tiny fraction of the planets they both called home. There was plenty of room for everyone. The driver's side door of the APC suddenly flew open, letting out a fair amount of the precious heat, while sending in a wave of frigid air into the cab. Adam wasn't wearing a coat, or even a thicker version of his enforcer uniform. He'd been either in a shuttle or a heated APC all day, and hadn't seen the need to get bundled up. "Damn it, Peanut, you're letting all the heat out!" Gil, Peanut, Norris, was being consumed by a bulky overcoat with a fur collar. Even still, he looked to be half frozen.
"Sorry, boss, but we got problems."
Peanut was a former Navy SEAL from Adam's old team back on Earth. He now carried the rank of Colonel in the Enforcers, one of Adam's command staff officers.
"The natives have surrendered," Peanut continued.
"That was expected. Why is that a problem?"
"The PCs ordered them to drop their weapons and then promptly opened up on them. They're slaughtering them in cold blood."
"Shit."
Adam leaned forward and snatched the comm unit from its holder on the dashboard.
"Get me the PC commander on a link."
He activated a data pad, which would give him video conferencing. A moment later, a gray-skinned alien came on the screen. "This is Adam Kane, head of the Enforcers. We're at an observation post north of your engagement area. I have reports that you're slaughtering native prisoners of war. Is this correct? If so, then you are to cease such action immediately." The alien blinked several times, overwhelmed by the intensity of Adam's demands. Then the creature looked off to the side, at someone who was speaking to him. The alien nodded and then stepped aside. Another person took his place. To Adam's shock, it was a human. The middle-aged man with a buzz-cut haircut and longish red beard had a sly grin on his tanned face, along with laughing brown eyes that seemed out of place under the current situation. "Who are you?" Adam demanded.
"I'm John Graham, the acting commander of the PC Security Force, and you are the famous Adam Kane."
The man had a distinctive Scottish accent.
"I'm told you're killing natives who have already surrendered, murdering them in cold blood."
"The enemy dies in battle. That's hardly murder."
"It is after they've laid down their weapons and surrendered."
"A technicality, Mr. Kane."
"I don't care what you call it. I order you to stop immediately."
Graham frowned.
"I'm sorry, but I don't see anywhere in my charter that I work for you. You can't give me orders."
"I can, if you don't want the full force of the Enforcers down on your head. We haven't taken sides in this conflict yet, but that's about to change."
"Relax, Kane. This will all be over in a few minutes. You see, the natives in question took something from me. I'm simply retrieving my property."
"Then take it and let the prisoners go."
"I'm afraid I can't do that. But as I said, don't worry. Once I have my package, I'm leaving this godforsaken planet. You and the damn natives can have it. After you killed my friend and benefactor, Wolfgang Stemmel, there's not much left to keep me here."
Peanut caught Adam's attention, having just gotten off his earcom.
"A shuttle's on the way down. ETA 10 minutes.
"I heard that," said Graham.
He grimaced.
"Unfortunately, I can't allow the shuttle to land. You see, my little operation here is off the books, and the fewer people who know about it, the better."
"I know about it," Adam countered.
"Yeah, but not for much longer."
"You wouldn't dare," Adam gasped. "I'm the head of the Enforcers."
"That you are. But you see, I checked with the garrison. They have no record of you being on Cornish Nor, and, unfortunately for you, the natives have begun disguising some of their units as Enforcer peacekeepers to keep their vehicles from being attacked. And since we checked, all we can assume is that you are one of those fake units."
Adam bit his bottom lip. In his haste, he didn't check in with the Enforcer garrison on Cornish Nor. All he wanted to do was drop down to the surface for a few hours and take in the smell of battle once again. Graham was right. No one on the surface knew he was here. And that was when the missile struck the APC. Chapter 2. Fortunately, the armored vehicle was of human design, with a reinforced undercarriage to protect against IEDs. The missile came in low and struck the ground just under the rear bumper, sending the APC flipping into the air. Adam wasn't belted in and was thrown first against the back of his seat and then the windshield. His forehead hit the padded dashboard, nearly knocking him out. He went limp, which helped him survive the tumbling as he bounced around the interior of the vehicle. The APC landed on its roof. It was built strong enough that the cab didn't collapse, leaving Adam battered inside, but not crushed. He looked over at Peanut. His friend's face was in agony, but he was alive.
"Are you okay?"
Adam asked.
"Arm's broken. This sucks.
What's wrong with that guy? There's going to be hell to pay for this.
I don't think he's done. He has gunships in the area. That's where the missile came from.
No sooner had Adam spoke the words than another powerful explosion rocked the area. He'd come with two APCs, and it looked as though both were now out of commission.
Can you get out through the window? He asked Peanut.
Yeah, I think so. Let's hurry. More missiles will be coming our way.
A moment later, Adam had Peanut's left arm hitched over his shoulder and was helping him to cover in a low depression in the hillside. Tim Robertson was there, along with three of the surviving alien enforcers, all members of Adam's escort team. He'd started with 12. Tim handed Adam a bar, one of the big-ass super rifles exclusive to the enforcers.
"Troops behind us down the hill," Tim reported.
He was another former SEAL, an aging warrior who had seen better days. Now his decades of combat experience were kicking in.
"We control the high ground, and we have the bars. The shuttle's on final approach."
Another missile streaked in and hit Adam's APC, this time striking it directly and blasting it into an unrecognizable hunk of twisted metal.
"Why are they shooting at us?" Tim asked. "Don't they know who we are?" "They do," Adam answered. "That's why they're working so hard to take us out."
"We can hold off the ground troops until the shuttle arrives, but it's that goddamn gunship that's the problem. The shuttle can't land with that thing hovering nearby."
Adam rolled over on the frigid ground and looked over at the gunship about half a mile away and 500 feet off the ground.
"All right, form a defensive line against the troops," Adam said to his human friends. "They're coming up the hill and should be within range in a couple of minutes. Let me see what I can do about the gunship."
"You mean by using your brain-linking device thingy?" Tim asked.
"That's right. Now let me concentrate."
Only a few humans in the Enforcer Corps knew of his ATD, besides Adam's inner core of longtime friends and associates. Tim and Peanut were two of them, although they professed not to understand how it worked or knew of its full potential. The device could detect and then link with a multitude of electronic devices, even going so far as manipulating the controls remotely. Adam's mutant friends Penor and Lila built his latest ATD, and it had all the bells and whistles. The gunship was well within range of the device. It wasn't hard to locate the massive energy signal coming from the gunship. Once connected with the ATD, the image of the hovercraft glowed in Adam's mind from a plethora of electronic signatures. The problem was, he had too many options. Finding which energy lines would produce the most damage to the aircraft was the challenge. He decided to trace down the power controls for the rotors. The hovercraft had four of them, two on each side. The enclosed blades could rotate forward or backward, and speed controlled the altitude. The gunship continued to spit rockets at Adam and his small entourage as precious minutes were spent tracing the hovercraft's control circuits. Finally, Adam had them located. He concentrated on the port side rotors, and once he had a firm lock on the junction boxes to the power units, he shut down the motors. The effect was dramatic and immediate. With the port side rotors off, the craft pitched sharply to the left, while the starboard rotors whipped the body up and sideways, placing the gunship into a wild, corkscrew-like spiral. With no sustaining lift, the ship barreled into the ground a few seconds later, catching the troops below it unaware. A roiling bloom of flame and smoke rose up from the ground. Adam did a quick survey of the energy signals from the variety of weapons the PC mercs carried, those who were being covered by the airship. There were few still registering. That still left the second group of PCs coming up the hill from the west.
"There it is!"
Tim shouted, pointing into the air above the smoky valley. Adam noticed the glint of sunlight off the metal hull of the shuttle and saw the craft approaching at incredible speed. The pilot was good, very good. and leveled out only moments before touching down, the rear loading ramp already down and locked. Yellow flash bolts began to fill the air around Adam and his troops, coming from down the hill. Blue bolts from the enforcer's bars answered the attackers, but even then, the PCs had over four times as many fighters as did Adam.
"Peanut, get everyone on board! Tim and I will provide cover. Now, go!"
Peanut was off a moment later, cradling his broken arm as he ran while barking orders at the variety of aliens that made up the Enforcer Corps. He positioned himself at the open doorway to the shuttle bay, firing with his bar one-handed at the quickly approaching mercenaries. Adam patted Tim on the shoulder.
"Go, I'm right behind you."
Tim took off, with Adam only a heartbeat behind. Adam scampered up the ramp, welcoming the thud of his footfalls on the hard metal surface of the loading ramp. His gaze met Peanut's, and the ginger-haired former SEAL turned and yelled into the cockpit.
"Lift off! Emergency procedures!"
The experienced pilot didn't have to be told. He gunned the spacecraft and shot off over the frozen landscape before angling up sharply, heading for space. Adam staggered back from where he stood, at the inner boundary of the loading ramp, still cradling the bar. Just then, the pilot made a radical shift to port to avoid an incoming missile. Adam lost his balance, dropping the bar before tumbling head over heels for the back of the shuttle and the still-open loading ramp. At the last second, his desperate right hand gripped the bottom locking rail to the ramp and held on, while the rest of his body dangled out the back of the shuttle. The craft was still rocketing for space, using full thrust to avoid the enemy missiles. The ramp was also closing under emergency procedures with no override. The entire closing procedure would take 3 seconds. With his hand about to be sliced off, Adam had no other option than to let go, free-falling backward through the cold air, 5,000 feet above the surface of Korish Nor.
Chapter 3.
Of course, 5,000 feet was only a guess, but Adam had enough experience with halo jumps with the SEALs to have a pretty good idea. He extended his arms to stabilize himself and saw the shuttle suddenly slow and begin a wide turn. What were they hoping to do, catch him in midair? That was crazy. Another missile shot past the shuttle, missing it by only feet. A split-second decision was made. Adam Kane was gone. There was nothing left to do but save the rest of the team and bolt for orbit. Relieved that the people aboard the shuttle would survive, Adam returned his focus on his current predicament. He'd already reached terminal velocity, and from his training he knew he only had about 30 seconds before impacting the ground. He had a little longer in the lighter gravity of Korish Nor, but that time was wasted by realizing he had extra time. Adam didn't panic. Knowing he could use his ATD to conjure up a static electricity field to compress the atmosphere into what he called a magic carpet, and then ride it safely to the ground. The problem was he was nearly frozen in the sub-zero air and was having trouble concentrating. Creating a field of static electricity strong enough to compress air to several thousand times normal pressure took complete concentration and a Herculean effort. That was under normal conditions, and not while falling at 200 miles per hour while quickly turning into an icicle. He closed his eyes to concentrate, but that didn't help. All that did was make his heart race, not knowing how close he was to the ground. He opened his eyes again, feeling the tears begin to freeze as he fell. Desperate people can do heroic feats when required. Eventually, Adam began to see the sparkling lights forming below him from the accumulation of static electricity drawn in by his ATD. The lights gave him hope. He could now feel a denser patch of warm air on his face and body. He was slowing down, although the ground was still rushing to meet him as if the scene were a video set on fast forward. As they say, it's not the fall that kills you, but rather the sudden stop. For Adam, the stop was sudden, but not fatal. his air cushion formed just in time to soften the fall. He landed on the semi-frozen ground.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?